Welcome to the Spinoza Podcast with Dr. Richard Miller, Dan Rowland, and myself, John Gibbs. In this episode, inspired by the turning of the year from 2021 to 2022, we reflect on our experiences as podcasters, what it's like, and what we've learned. And I think the conversation then moves on to the world as we see it in 2021 and the way it might be in 2022. Some old themes are discussed, some new ideas emerge, and I think we end up reflecting that it is essential to remember to feed cows as well as weigh them. Dan, you just asked me how long we've been doing that. I think the first one out without checking in March. So we're not a year old yet. The Spinoza Podcast has yet to reach first anniversary.
Big moments in our history.
I think in media history, it will be noted.
Yes. Yeah. Move packs across all our houses. Well, this is where it started.
It's a slow burn, the old podcast business. We were talking about stuff like this long before we ever podcasted it. So,
Yeah. We've been talking about this for years, haven't we? Too long.
We did Spinoza more like a reading group, and we didn't record it. I have vivid memories of recording that podcast, and they're not real.
Absolutely.
We just spoke about it.
Well, I mean, there's Spinoza, who we have never talked about as a podcast focus. And yet that was the initial. It was an observation by you, Rich, that have you heard of Spinoza? And I said, yeah, I've heard of Spinoza, and that is it.
Yeah.
That started it.
And we started because of our...
Try it's an in joke. It must be unamusing. You were remarking, Dan, you know, how do you promote podcasts? Probably not call yourselves the Triad is one way.
Exactly.
Have some sort of catchier title.
Yeah.
How to live your life.
It was all part of our continuing professional development, wasn't it? CPD.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's like our subversion of that idea.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But we got the tick in the right box.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but yeah, that triad takes us back to the very recent discussion on Mark Fisher, and the thought from the beginning was the reason we were mocking this idea of being instructed by our employers to conduct a triad was because of that formalization of ordinary professional life, which de-skilled us. The sense that we sat there thinking, being told to do something that you do anyway. Because you're a teacher. It's like being told to prepare lessons. You think, well, I'm a teacher. Obviously, I do that.
And then demonstrate that you have prepared lessons.
Yeah, then demonstrate it so that it can then be logged. And that thing has then occurred.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the demonstration is more important than the actual doing of said job. The demonstration of the job is more important.
So looking back over this year, one of the themes that has come up from the beginning of this enterprise has been the incursion into reality of the media. I think that's come up a lot in our podcasts. We've talked about a way in which private life, consumer life, education has been acquired by this new media. We, as men of a certain age, can remember time before the internet and so on. Not before television, obviously, but before the internet.
So, I mean, originally we were doing this to find out about people we didn't know about. At certain points, we've looked at issues as much, which has then drawn on people that, I wonder sometimes if we go over the same people. Dan, you've mentioned this before, Spinoza. But it would be nice this year to, again, pick on some obscure people I've got no idea about. And we could do some more podcasting around that.
As an exercise in staving off Alzheimer's, clearly there is a purpose there. And that, I think that's been one of the themes for me this year, personally, has been the difference between knowing about things and trying to understand them in a little more detail. Before we came on, we were just talking about the difference between the sort of blagget knowledge, which is actually quite a good knowledge, having some knowledge, little knowledge of lots of things, as opposed to the in-depth knowledge.
Well, that's what we originally tried to do before we started recording. We just wanted to meet. It was during lockdown, wasn't it? We were just going to meet to discuss philosophy and find out more about the things we didn't really know much about. So reading about it and getting up to speed with it and then challenging each other with what we found out. I thought it was quite a good idea.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed it.
Also, it's a forum to engage in a kind of discussion, which I find doesn't normally happen in social conversation.
Exactly. So, what's wrong with him? What's he talking about?
Yeah, you are the only people that I will properly. I can bore students in the days when I was teaching. I can bore students on this stuff, but I can, you know, but actually yeah. to converse with people about it, it doesn't crop up a lot. Ordinary conversation can be politics, dodge around religion, don't talk about it too much in case you offend someone, a little bit of politics, not too much. Mostly it's social interaction concerns, the doings and goings on of your life and those around you, which is fine.
Yeah.
It's really nice to have those sort of social conversations, but whether or not...
it's not as challenging. No. And maybe that's why it's more taboo, because these topics are quite challenging to...
But we were talking about culture, weren't we?
Based on ideas.
The idea of thinking about these kinds of things was quite a celebrated biography of Kant's, where he was talking about his greatest part of his day was having his walk and having a think. And that was generally one of the greatest things you can do, is walking and thinking, and we don't have that space now.
I wonder, and I think, Dan, you've wondered this too as well, is this sort of whether or not we are just generally a less sort of serious culture, in the sense that, poem by Philip Larkin about equal church going, where he goes into a church, and Philip Larkin's not a believer in Christianity or God. There's a line in the poem where he says, well, places like this, I'm paraphrasing now, places like this always exist. He says, because, quote poem, people will be forever, it's a serious place, and people will be forever surprising in themselves a hunger to be more serious.
That's interesting, yeah.
That thought you have in a churchyard, that thought you have on a walk on a day in the countryside, that thought you have maybe in the shower, that serious thought. I don't think we live in a particularly serious culture, right?
No, it's a very childish culture.
It's a culture which is technologically determined now. Postman's point that our culture is determined by the technology that we have. I think the evidence of this is the reluctance to read books. You know, it's not a cultural activity. I mean, obviously people still do, but the phone limits that, because you can arrive at summaries. It encourages you to flick through and not focus on any one thing. So thought becomes affected by it. It's a stripping back of consciousness. It's been replaced by culture. Consciousness becomes something which is thought about in that sense, but I think it's a business ontology. The way you think about yourself and the world around you being thought of in some way that fitted with the technology, which is...
Yeah, we're moving towards the metaverse. Everything is much more fractured.
Just faster.
Faster and based around entertainment.
It's faster, but is it also less substantial, you know, less deep?
Society is an audience now, rather than a collection of rational individual thinkers who might have different individual thoughts and be able to know why. So why populism is so big now. People tend to put themselves into camps and say, this is who I am. But you could see the same in even before this hyper-technology that we live through, with the idea of empire. You know, in the modern age, nobody questioned the British Empire. And that was way before the internet. Britain is the best civilising influence in the world. You know, nobody questioned it. So maybe it goes before that. So maybe this goes deeper. Maybe maybe technology is speeding it along. But society is, as a whole, is quite essentially shallow.
Faster and faster, more and more information. And the only thing the technology can do is make it shorter and shorter. So you get more and more information, much faster images, and just going quickly through, because there's so much stuff.
Yeah, Richard, that quality of faster and faster, the speed, I think is an important characteristic of this late modernity, this postmodern or even hypermodern world. It's the ideas of people like Frederick Jameson who suggest the disorientation, the confusion, the lack of certainty, that is built into the experience of post-modernity.
Everybody's producing media now, that's the difference. So therefore it can't be in the same depth as perhaps you would have had time to think. It's just like the experience of being a student now. Rather than reading a set text and engaging with it as a book, you now have a series of summaries. So you just arrive at the summary rather than engaging with the text itself, which has a little bit of other byproducts of you thinking about your own experiences and what you think about the characters and the development. And the actual act of reading takes longer to do, so you have to sit there and think for longer to do that. It's just seen as not efficient, whereas if you can get a summary of something and you can work efficiently, that's part of the thing that's affecting consciousness. And I think it's a very real thing. Leave your phone at home for the day, see how you feel when you walk out the door. It's an anxiety there.
One word you used there, which is very interesting, I think struck me as you were saying it, was the word efficiency, how that's become one of the dominant narratives of our age. Now, how many times in some meeting or other you talk to drill down into the data? This must be robustly proved. But what they really mean is the efficiency through a sort of level of superficial simplification. without questioning the underlying premise of things.
Yeah, evidence is and you could also argue that evidence in modern discussions has replaced argument. So we look at proof rather than reason. So even the stuff with people's first line is what's the best thought or what's the best reason for doing something? They'll say, what does the data say? Like we see with the COVID proposals, it's always about the data rather than what is the most reasonable thing to do.
And it's almost like for a highly data, sort of a highly technologically literate society, we've forgotten that rubbish in, rubbish out, the old idea that the data itself is not neutral, but it's presented as neutral.
Yeah.
The replacement with symbols and data grading and targets doesn't necessarily reflect the thing itself. It's not enough to keep weighing the cow. You must feed it. Testing, assess, test, assess. The whole economy of data, though, it's a really interesting area prevalent in people's lives.
And becomes difficult to question and becomes a kind of tyranny. That Neil Postman idea that you in the end become the servant of the data rather than data is a useful tool for you. The tool becomes the master. Mm. In the end, it's the production of data that becomes the purpose of the organization, the purpose of what you're... And that's certainly true in education. We've seen that over the years. The dominance of grades, the dominance of grading, the dominance of... We didn't even talk about this last time, but dominance of targeting. As educators, we can see that because we experience that. But we put the radio on, and you'll hear that Britain is doing badly because some indicator of the value of the pound or the amount of shopping we're doing. Phrases like footfall on the high street. And I'll listen to the radio and I'll be told that footfall on the high street is up or footfall on the high street is down. It will be clearly presented to me that if we're shopping more and it's measurably shopping more, then that is a good thing and all is right with the world.
Yeah, and the news now is just like an extension of retail news. It's like getting a daily subscription to the grocer. There's no real ideas or thoughts. It's just based upon loose economic news. Are we looking at a golden age where news encourage people to think more?
But you have to remember, I think, though, Dan, that when we look at historically the news, I mean, it's owned and controlled by people with, doesn't just exist in a neutral sense, just as data and does now, and information. Conversations like this about efficiency and data will just merge into new forms of technology.
If you look at a BBC programme from the 1960s, you'll see that the longer takes and the more in-depth interviews, much greater detail and also greater recognition or nods to people's intelligence.
The news is presented today. I mean, it always irritates me, but this is going to sound like a trivial point, but never mind. When you're watching the news and they can't interview someone by like showing you a portrait image of them sitting in a chair talking, it has to zoom in on their eyeball or up their nose,
hands,
or from behind, or their hand moving or something. It's like, well, am I so visually likely to going to lose the audience after a minute? Every now and again, you have to sort of change the image.
Great point. Time the tapes, looking at something from the 1960s, like interview with Martin Luther King, and then look at a tape now. And you're going to see that you can have a tape for nearly a minute, 60 seconds of someone just talking. Now you won't get more than five or 10 seconds.
But the old BBC's inform and educate, and if possible, entertain. If you want to see the old BBC, it's full.
It's reform, re-educate and reinforce a class system.
You can see both those things in the... you've probably come across it on the internet. You can see Brian McGee. I forget the series, but it's a series of about 9 programmes he did. Brian McGee's a philosopher.
So good,
And he interviews... Yeah. Basically, it's two chaps, generally a philosopher or writer. I mean, Marcuse was there on one of them. Mm. And they sit at each end of a large brown sofa. Because it's the 1970s, they're also wearing brown. Everything is generally brown. And they're sitting in brown sofas with brown suits on, and they discuss Schopenhauer or Marx or Marcuse, like 45 minutes to an hour, two chaps talking philosophy.
And the great thing about that was open to everyone.
I don't think it was, Dan. I think it normalised middle-aged white guys from a certain educational background. It's accessible if you have the same understanding as us. That's the message of it. And I think if you look for it, with the one thing sort of new media does allow is is an option for everyone at every level to engage with. Because people can actually make videos themselves now as well. And this is what I think. And people comment on it sometimes, especially with a subject like philosophy, is it's been so prioritized at certain groups over others. And so we were chatting before we started recording, just on the way, sort of the exclusive nature of some forms of philosophy, which is why the popularity of people like Jordan Peterson, who are really doing what the Greeks did, you know, how should you lead a good life? You know, and he's got his book, 12 Steps, then you'll agree with him or disagree, it doesn't matter.
In the 40s and 50s, there was the working class improvement and continuing education and things like the Everyman Library and all that kind of thing. So there was a huge, and working men's clubs doing courses and things like that, where people were really interested in ideas. And it wasn't, education did finish 14 officially for a lot of people, but it continued in that great tradition. I think the BBC, I know you can say it's led by white middle-class men of a certain age, but it was trying to get everyone up to a certain level and not talking down to people. Yes, of course, people might not have tuned in, but you'd be surprised at the level of audience figures for some of these programmes, like Panorama in the 60s. We're talking millions of people watching it, and there was no dumbing down, no talking down to people. And the level of articulation amongst people of all walks of life talking was much higher than it is today.
But I mean, the response to that, though, isn't that like, sorry, John, but I mean, I think that still exists now. Some brilliant academic style teachers who are making ideas available. And it isn't that the same thing. It's just they're just using slightly different mediums.
He's saying this is Jordan Peterson's view of the world. And he probably absorbed several philosophies, and he's a psychologist in Canada, but he's putting himself first and he's got a following. And then we're saying that thing, if he's got a following, is that therefore good? If someone's talking about great ideas and there's only, let's say, 500,000 people tuning in, does that make it less worthy than someone who's got millions of people on Instagram?
I think he does teach pretty well. He's basically a Jungian thinker, and he puts those ideas across with really accessible examples. And I think very often you can go through an education now and not be exposed to those ideas. And what he does very well is he makes, through the examples he uses, he makes quite difficult concepts relevant and understandable. So,
I mean, he's often talking to disappointed men of a certain level of youth who are a bit confused about their role. He says in a very high-pitched voice, guys, you've just got to man up. Just got to make your bed.
His key thing is, I think, about responsibility. It's about having individual responsibility. And I don't agree with his critiques of ideology and his worldview, perhaps, on universality and collective ideas. But the very fact that he's launching the other side of the argument, it's important to then know why you don't agree with it or agree with it. On his podcast, his psychoanalytic readings of the Old Testament are good. Psychoanalytic reading the archetypes of the Old Testament, absolutely fascinating. And I know the Rules for Life books are, I think they're useful for a lot of people. You know, it's if you read Epictetus, you know, it's not all amazing. It's just I see him in the same mould.
I agree that much of late antiquity's philosophy, the Epicureans, the Stoics, the Skeptics, are, in a sense, self-help books. They're how you get through being mortal.
Well, how you lead a good life.
In a sense, though, we're still, and I know we tend to do that, which is great, because in discussion you should circle around. And I think we tend to circle around the same kind of dilemma that this, and it's a big dilemma. It's a very important one, I think. And it's the dilemma of depth over breadth. Mm. And we live in a society of extraordinary breadth. This machine that got in front of me, this laptop, has got access to the greatest library that any human being, the Library of Alexandria or the British Museum Library, nothing like this.
Yeah.
And yet a lot of it, I'll have to navigate my way through it, because a lot of it will be highly superficial, highly partisan, highly partial, highly designed to make me watch kittens falling out of baskets. It'd be distracting.
Welcome to the Society of Spectacle. It's the carnivalesque, the grotesque, is ordinary.
We wander through the world as if in some carnival, dark and looming faces and masks of clowns and voices shouted and smells and distractions. Here is the society, where in the words of W.B. Yeats, the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity. Passionate intensity is commonplace in our society. Fearful intensity, harvested and used and subverted by others, kept mountebanks and manipulators and snake oil salesmen like Trump, who use this world of superficial but intense anger. Here today, gone tomorrow, angry on a moment, turning into passion, fearful, at a loss, surprised, illusorily surprised, uncertain about the world. All these things loom up around us. The morning, when the sunlight comes up, we could see, couldn't we, how tawdry, how broken it all was, how thick the makeup was painted. How destructive our society is of the world. It's as if some hedonistic dream is being acted around us. Faster and faster, faster music all the time. Clowns, illusion, jumping, falling. It's a frenzy of intensity and meaninglessness. It is the carnivalesque world. Then also we worry, don't we, about whether this highly engaging, superficial kind of culture has got some rather malign bread and circuses kind, the distraction culture. So, you know, I think these are big questions. That when I watch something like BBC's famous 1970s TV series, Civilization, with Kenneth Clarke, first big high-budget documentary series in which they get the historian, the art historian Kenneth Clarke, to travel all over Europe and present a series called Civilization. And in a sense, it's almost immediately impossible to be anything but politically incorrect with that enterprise now, because his assumption is that civilization starts with the Greeks and moves through Western Europe. Highly contentious.
And there's no mention of China or
No, he doesn't mention China. China doesn't mention it at all. Basically, starts with the Greeks. It reaches some sort of high point in the Renaissance. And they're beautifully made art history documentaries, which you feel at the end of an episode, you really need to study art history because so many things have been looked at, so many things have been mentioned. And I don't entirely feel unedified by it. I feel I've enjoyed and been improved in some strange way by watching the series. It's a highly ideologically narrow view of what civilization is. The two old men on the sofa and the BBC telling you, this is good, this is high culture, pay attention. Had behind it an aspiration. And it comes back to that Mark Fisher thing, doesn't it, about modernity's aspirations are only left to style now.
That's what I was... You've said that in a sentence that I was just trying to mumble my way through earlier. That's the point I was trying to make. We replace substance with style.
Dan, can you just... That where you said, well said, John, can you say that a bit louder? Because that's going to have that in the podcast. Highlighted.
Yeah, totally agree. You said that. I was mumbling my way through.
I might even start. I might put that at the beginning and the end. You might hear yourself say that several times.
If your thoughts are always mediated through a phone, and you're just checking out, I'm just looking at this. If that's constantly happening, we don't think enough. Also, the neutrality of cyberspace, just like the history of ideas, if you like, is ideologically structured in such a way that normalizes a white class system.
Yeah.
I think at the same time, the ownership and control of the internet, where it might seem very neutral on the one hand, absolutely isn't. Algorithms are shaping literally the way we think. But on the other hand, you can also sit there with a phone on your sofa and find out more about pretty much anything that you could have done in the greatest library 30 years ago. So the space is there. You do have your public intellectuals, and there are people you can go and find who can offer thought and ideas which you couldn't before.
And Richard, if you search the podcast, you can come across the Spinoza Triad.
Yeah.
A recent edition, not yet a year old.
Not be selling ourselves.
Which I would recommend to anyone who wants an in-depth conversation of these matters.
Yeah.
We're all professors of nonsense.
Thank you. in a sense, our podcasting is a response that we personally have made to this world that's both
an opportunity to research and find and discuss and read almost anything that has been created by humanity and has been recorded is there. You can be as superficial as Wikipedia or go down the rabbit hole of research on your own, or you can read the texts of the Republic or Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil if you wish, from the comfort of your own armchair. And yet, at the same time, around us, cacophonous, distracting culture, and one that endlessly repeats and reconstructs and pastiches and reuses ideas of the immediate past, calling them postmodern, or playful, or carnivalesque. So the Spinozas, in their own way, are an attempt to pause and think seriously, if possible.
Yes,
that's right.
Dan, me and Dan can give you a predicted grade, John.
And then we can tell you whether you're a good reader or not.
If you listen on Audible, it sends you little things like, well done, you've read so many books this week. And I feel quite pleased. Oh, well done.
Yeah. But I mean, that's another example, is it? The product is defining the cultural practice.
If it's free, you are the product. You're being data mined. So it's funny how the internet, you're using the internet, how the internet works you as well. It turns you into a product, even though you think it's the height of freedom.
I think that's an interesting insight. I'm not sure what I do about it, though.
Leave your phone at home. Human beings are not meant to be products. Human beings are meant to be rational, independent agents that think. And our culture and our civilization, to use that rather poncy term, still believes that. But slowly, the humanity of culture is being emptied out and we're left with just this husk. And that's partly what the culture wars are about. It's just talking about memories of a time when things seemed to make sense or didn't make sense, and real antagonisms. But
you mentioned, though, the culture wars there. I think it changed that much now. You know, if you look at the old arguments about high popular mass culture, and the right felt mass culture would interfere with the hierarchy or the structure of good ideas, great ideas, and high culture. The left's argument, the limited revolutionary potential.
Also, in that debate, the left embraced high culture. Some of the left embraced high culture as for its antagonistic force. Seeing Shakespeare or reading Dostoevsky became a means by which you questioned the accepted realities of your day.
It gives you a set of conceptual tools, doesn't it, to critically engage with the world.
So it is possible to see our contemporary concerns about information technology, about the internet, about social media, as being just the same debate, what you described there, Richard, as the culture debate from the 19th century onwards. On the left, Marx are looking at popular culture and seeing it as a means by which the false consciousness or the distraction culture or the bread and circuses were going to pull people away from the reality. And whereas high culture might introduce them to that reality, or a sort of Brechtian theatre, it might be act as a didactic mechanism or an antagonistic force, as I said earlier. And back in the 19th century, people like Matthew Arnold were arguing that, or I've often thought that if Matthew Arnold bumped into Karl Marx, I think they overlap in time, I'm sure they do, in the National Gallery looking at a Rembrandt, they'd get on quite nicely. Their view of art would be very similar. They would see it as serving the purposes of raising consciousness. High art, high culture. I mean, it's no wonder the Soviet Union embraces ballet and high culture and promotes in its propaganda the idea that the workers spend their free lunch hours reading poetry to each other. Unfortunately, I think, and we have a tendency, I mean those around us who look at contemporary culture in a critical way, will have a tendency to take a view, an elitist view of popular culture. It's easy to do. It's easy to embrace the idea is that art in its beauty, in its highest form, in the best that can be thought and said, reflects beauty, and beauty reflects truth. And through that truth, from the left or the right, you are either educating the lumpen proletariat or educating the barbaric unwashed masses, or enjoying things that they are too stupid to understand.
I could press a button to not. Wizard of Oz. Thank God, I'll be the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Although he's a bit of a charlatan, isn't he? To the Wizard of Oz.
He's a very small little power. Man.
I'll have to be something with actual power.
Man behind
and if
the
I could
screen,
be that and not have the internet, or go back to the 1970s, and we were just basically the internet never gets discovered. It's just not technically possible. I wouldn't uninvent the internet. I wouldn't uninvent modern technology.
No, but think how society, because there's no end to what you can know, you end up knowing nothing.
I think culturally the issue, Daniel, for me there is, if you go back historically, there was a hierarchy of ideas.
Oh, God, yeah, totally.
Modern living culturally is the prioritizing of relativism.
Yeah, but stuff which is metaphysical or essential or philosophical isn't relative. There's nothing relative about death. There's nothing relative about birth. Mm. There's nothing relative about poverty in all its expressions. You know, so obviously you have relative poverty, but you have rich and poor. You have life and death. These are things which everyone has to contend with. You can't have a personal opinion of. Mm. You can have an emotional response to. But these things are going to happen. With this relativism, we're losing the universal of the human experience. And that's part of the problem with the internet.
Definitely.
Everything is becoming relativized and personal. So nobody can then relate on a metaphysical level about what it means to be a human being for the short period of time we're on Earth for. You know, because that's opening up dangerous religious questions. But you can have those kind of questions like the ancients did without referring to religion.
Yes.
That's what Aristotle does. He's talking about great universals. And we're losing that in our burrowing into the internet. We're losing that ability to deal with universal human themes. That's the trouble with postmodernism. Because it's seen as a dangerous idea that there is a universal thing that all human beings are having to experience. Everyone will die. Everyone is born. Everyone has expectations and hopes and dreams. All these ideas should be treated universally rather than as a kind of atomized individual. And I think that's what philosophy is trying to do, is trying to put the universal back, which is kind of reassuring. The thing that the individual hangs their reality on, which is a sense of normality. It's like trying to have a room without walls. You need the wall to define your space. Death is a boundary. That's the limit. That's all you get. That's why these things are quite taboo in our modern society, which is endlessly frothy and optimistic. Our lives become like an advert.
I think the danger, perhaps, is trying to put an ethical, moral outcomes. The internet itself is just a form of technology. It allows space. I mean, it does so many good things.
It's draining the universal from us, I think.
Well, I would say that all media has a potential to do that. The process is, as you said, accelerating. I mean, that probably people in 1850 complained about the superficiality of the newly emerging consumer society. Then they complained about penny dreadfuls, and they complained about television was stopping people reading books.
Yeah.
And all those things are true. And now you're saying something more than that about the internet. And certainly the way it's all pervasive nature, not just the internet, but technology and data, is something, again, we should be concerned about. But I wouldn't uninvent it, I don't think.
No, I would uninvent it, but I just say you also need to invent new ways of being, or perhaps reinvent old ways of being with the new technology.
And what you seem to be describing is that we're distancing us from the profound. We're embarrassed by the profound. Just before we came on, I was saying to you that one of the things I'd read, Dickens' Christmas Carol, actually read it as opposed to knowing it. And found I knew it, but I'd now read it. Dickens is in that in his own sentimental way, but he's asking the reader through a Christmas story. The trouble is it's been so sentimentalized and so reproduced that it's hard to get back to what is actually quite profound. He's talking about Christmas as a ritual, and the ritual revealing a way in which the character of Scrooge has to reevaluate his life. In a very profound, almost Freudian kind of way, he goes back to the past. He shows him the past. He shows him the origins of his development. Who is that boy seated alone? It's you, Scrooge. He's saying, well, you had a dysfunctional childhood, a dysfunctional family. You were cruelly treated, and you developed an attitude of cruelty and greed as a result. And you can redeem yourself here. Well, these are quite profound ideas. And ideas of redemption and ritual are maybe a little masked by the festival of consumption. I mean, I know I'm saying something a bit trite there about Christmas being all about eating these days and such like, which I've indulged in heavily. but it's also the drawing out of meaning from ritual. Ever thought about your funeral? Or been to a funeral and thought, how do we do death in this society? In a society where we're at least ambiguous or slightly distanced from or uncertain about eternity and whatever. So how do you do death when it doesn't become just a disposal mechanism? I saw something in the press the other day, these things called simple funerals. And a simple funeral is simply they sort of basically deal with the body quick. Mm. It's effectively
cover box.
Corpse disposal. So, like, you know, so you can say, oh, Gran died and she's been disposed of. Moving on. It doesn't interfere with you in any troubling manner at all. Big wedding festivals of consumption and glitz and appearance.
Yeah.
And you know, kind of less of the profound.
The sacred. Sacred's being drained out of life.
It's very difficult to reassert the sacred in a
profane world. We live in a profane world. Yeah.
But I don't think there's an all-knowing God who knows my existence at all. I can't believe in that.
No.
And yet, on the other hand,
the ancients, without God, they had a sense of the sacred, the idea that things are very, very special, without necessarily pointing towards God. So we lose the art of things being really, really special. As soon as you start saying this is really, really important, really special, it's either over-personalized or it's treated with irony.
Interesting.
Yeah, we mentioned... we were talking about...
We all go through this, therefore it's a rite of passage. It's,
you know, we've mentioned Jordan Peterson a few times. He has that idea where he says that you should act as if God exists, regardless of whether or not you believe or not. You know, you act as if, because
it makes you a better person.
His argument would be that, again, there's quite a few arguments around.
Yeah, I don't know. Either turns out a sort of cynical Pascal's wager, isn't it? I'll believe in God just in case there is one. I don't really, you know.
Oh, no, not because of outcomes. No, the actual process of
change. He's...
It's not about outcomes.
The trouble is with that view is I tend to want to believe it for other people. If there's some sort of loutish behaviour on the news, or you encounter some thoughtless bloke in the co-op, you think, well, a bit of God wouldn't go amiss here, would it? For them, but not for me.
Yeah. I wasn't talking about a deity or God. I'm just saying human beings deciding themselves what is special. What is sacred, like they did in the ancient times. They didn't refer to a god. Closest Plato gets to is the sun. But you're not hearing about a deity just looking down over people. It's people deciding how to behave and responding to universal themes. Now, we're not having that anymore. We don't have any universal in our interactions with each other.
Dan, that process you're describing, you mentioned Nietzsche earlier, John, that was one of his main ideas, that, you know, if God is dead, what then do you do? And his idea was overcome yourself to become a better version of yourself.
Yeah, that's the point.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you can assert meaning in a meaningless world, then either you have to do it through an act of will or an act of reason, or a combination of those things. And that makes you more, as Nietzsche would have it, I guess, more human. More profoundly human.
All too human.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, in the end, I mean, the trouble is with that view as well is that you find yourself wondering if you're not shouting in the darkness. You know, you've run to the mountaintop and seen the sunrise.
But you wouldn't be doing it on your own. This is what Aristotle's talking about. These universal themes makes you realize you've got more in common with people than not. And this is the thing we just don't refer to anymore because it seems taboo and difficult and awkward.
Oh, well.
Great universal themes. And also always associated with God.
You should insert that bit from Christmas Carol now where he flings open the window and he sees all the spirits floating past. And he says, what are they doing, the spirits? He says, they are desperate. They're wringing their hands and wailing. He says, why are they wringing their hands and wailing? He says, they're desperate to intervene for good in mankind, but they can't now because they're dead. They wish they had in life.
Right, yeah.
That's very profound, actually.
Interesting, yeah.
Nowadays, they'd be rubbing their hands because they can't find a charger for their iPhone. They had it in life. But
in death,
they can get in charge.
You have been listening to the Spinoza Triad with John Gibbs, Dan Rowland, and Dr. Richard Miller, as we discuss contemporary issues in relation to philosophical ideas. If you have any suggestions for things we might discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on our podcast, please contact us through the website. If, however, you've enjoyed this discussion and you know other people who might be similarly afflicted, please recommend it to them on your social media. Thanks for listening. Scrooge followed to the window. Desperate in his curiosity, he looked out. The air was filled with phantoms, wandering hither and thither in restless haste, and moaning as they went. Every one of them wore chains like Marley's ghost. Some few, they might be guilty governments, were linked together. None were free. Many had been personally known to Scrooge in their lives. He had been quite familiar with one old ghost in a white waistcoat with a monstrous iron safe attached to its ankle, who cried piteously at being unable to assist a wretched woman with an infant whom it saw below upon a doorstep. The misery with them was clearly that they sought to interfere for good in human matters and had lost the power forever.